They're telling us we aren't going to know anything about him. You'll notice when the universal censor in paper 10 debates, will we get to the deity absolute, he hedges. But then he says flatly, we'll never get up to the universal absolute. The question of the unqualified absolute just doesn't even come up. He's two absolutes removed from that which is debatable. Let it be made clear that the unqualified absolute is a positive reality pervading the grand universe and apparently extending with equal space presence on out into the force activities and pre-material evolutions of the staggering stretches of the space regions beyond the seven superuniverses. In paper 12, they speak of the four outer space levels as the domains of the unqualified absolute. The unqualified absolute is not a mere negativism of philosophic concept, predicated on the assumptions of metaphysical sophistries concerning the universality, dominance, and primacy of the unconditioned and the unqualified. The unqualified absolute is a positive universe over control in infinity. This over control is space force unlimited, but is definitely conditioned by the presence of life, mind, spirit, and personality, and is further conditioned by the will reactions and purposeful mandates of the Paradise Trinity.
Something like this?
Well, that's a mouthful. To me, that means that when the Paradise Trinity takes snuff, the unqualified absolute sneezes. Yes?
That space force.
That's that space potency, I think.
Unlimited.
Mm-hmm. There's no limit to the ability of the unqualified absolute to release his grasp of space potency.
Would that domain go beyond the borders of the fourth outer space level?
I'm sure it does, because it's unlimited. And that is a limit.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. We get the foundations for Cosmos Infinite here.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it's quite large. You ain't fenced in.
I always wonder how large. I mean, how large is infinity?
Many.
More than many.
Many, many. There's many to the second power.
In other words, how many acres
yes.
did the original IM contract for before he started all this?
He's got an open-end account.
He's got everything.
Okay.
It's the best way I can express it. He's got an open-end account.
What is this IM?
The IM is not a reality. The IM is the concept back in the first frame. And remember, we entered the looking glass in the last frame. Everything on the blackboard is behind the looking glass, save only the last picture. The I Am is a conceptual concession which they make to our thinking. We want a starting point, and so they give it to us. Now, the infinite, maybe, is a better concept. The Father infinite is maybe still better. We are convinced that the unqualified absolute is not an undifferentiated and all-pervading influence comparable either to the pantheistic concepts of metaphysics or to the sometime ether hypothesis of science. Pantheism assumes that there is a God and he's everywhere. In other words, we are God, Bud's house is God, Tiglath is God, and so on. This takes God and so atomizes him that it is equivalent to no God. The ether hypothesis of science assumes that space is a very fine-grained reality called ether. And of course, space is not a fine-grained reality. Space is emptiness from the finite standpoint. The unqualified absolute is force unlimited. No end to space potency. They aren't going to run out. Every time they drill for a nebulae, they're going to hit a gusher. The unqualified absolute is deity conditioned. Well, that's that linkage up there. When total deity acts, well, let's start it up better. When the Trinity, when the Paradise Trinity acts in the final sense, this activates the deity absolute. This activation of the deity absolute is transmitted through the universal absolute to the unqualified absolute, and in this way, the unqualified absolute is deity conditioned. We do not fully perceive the relation of the unqualified absolute to the spirit realities of the universes. I don't think there's any direct relation, except through the unifying and equipoising presence of the universal absolute, but there is no perceivable relationship directly. The universal absolute, we logically deduce, was inevitable. When the universal father's absolute free will act differentiated universe realities into deified and undeified, personalizable and non-personalizable values. See frame 2 on the blackboard. You can't stop with frame 2. You've got instantly to go on to frame 3. This relationship is a reality, and it deitizes. I don't say personalizes, it deitizes. The universal absolute is the deity phenomenon indicative of the resolution of the tension created by the free will act of thus differentiating universe reality. Frame 2 sets up an intolerable stress in infinity. When you break the balance in frame 1, you set up a chain reaction in frame 2, and a stress situation is created which must be resolved. Hence, you must go forward to frame 3, which now resolves the stress. You see what God's doing? He's setting up not devils and hells as threats. He's setting up stresses and then resolving those stresses in one way or another. He sets up a stress in a human being when he puts an adjuster in that human being. And that stress to me could be symbolized by saying that there's a rubber band stretching all the way back to Divinington, where the adjuster came from, to paradise, to all practical intents and purposes. This adjuster wants to cohere in the Father. And this adjuster is attached to us. And unless we actually snap that rubber band, the tension of that rubber band will draw us into paradise. But we can cut the rubber band, Betty. When the Father sets up a situation in time and space where energy matter is dominant, and then puts people and mind and spirit out here, he challenges them. He challenges these people. Can you take over now? You've got the mind to do it. Can you so affiliate mind with spirit that your takeover is stable and progressive? Or Will you fail to affiliate mind with spirit, in which event your successes will be evanescent and ephemeral? They'll be here today and gone tomorrow. That is a temporal victory in contrast to an eternal victory. Temporal victories are undone. Eternal victories stand forever. The Universal Absolute resolves the tension created by the free will act of differentiating universe reality into two phases, personalizable and non-personalizable. The Universal Absolute functions as the associative coordinator of these sum totals of existential potentialities, frame 3. Does the Universal Absolute remind you of anything else in reality?
For a long time, I couldn't get away from the Universal Absolute being, in a sense, a tool of the deity. But that does away with the idea of coordinator.
It is a tool.
Does it work automatically in response, or does it...
I think the Universal Absolute is intelligent, purposive, and all those things. The Universal Absolute, to me, is most like the conjoint actor. And those two are most like the first source and center, extending across the board, dealing with the personal and the impersonal. Much as the Universal Absolute unifies the non-personal unqualified with the personalizable deity absolute.
We've got to draw a line though between the conjoint actor and the Universal Absolute.
But consider the relationship of the conjoint actor to the spiritual domains of the Eternal Son and to the physical domains of the Isle of Paradise. Here on the level of actuality we see a functional coordination which is analogous to this unification taking place on the level of potentiality. I see a greater kinship between the conjoint actor and the Universal Absolute than between any other two of the seven original realities.
But they are seven.
Of course they are, entirely. I see a greater functional relationship between Paradise and the Unqualified Absolute. If I want to get any feeling for the Unqualified Absolute, I'm going to study Paradise. This is non-personal, extra-divine, and undeified, and it's actual, not just potential. And it's infinite in potential. No matter how much mass appears in space, Paradise will generate enough gravity to hold it very effectively in leash. The gravity potential of Paradise is unlimited. When I think of the deity absolute, I see, in some ways, a greater kinship with the Eternal Son. The deity absolute is personalizable, deified, divine, and nothing but that. And that is true of the Son. You might say, well, why don't you compare it with the Father? Because the Father is all things which the Son are and everything which the Son is not. The Father is the source of Paradise as well as Father of the Eternal Son. It's the wrong word, the first source and center, I should say. That's even larger than the concept of the first person of deity. Now we're thinking of the deified aspect of the Universal Father. He's also everything else.
If you re-scramble the last frame there, you would have to come, scramble it up into a scrambled egg. You'd have to call it the first source.
Oh, yes. You'd be back.
You'd be back.
Virtually, there. Yes, yes.
You'd be back to the Lord, the Absolute, the God of the Absolute, God of the Absolute.
I think of these steps as representing the only steps which God could take at that time. As you start in the first frame, there's a, He's only got two choices, as I see it. Leave it alone or separate it. Or scramble it. In the second frame, he has only two choices. Go back where we came from, or set up a tension resolver so that we stay where we are by adding a third thing. In the fourth frame, it would appear to me he has only one choice, or two. Leave it the way it is, in which event I now fill the total of deity and can do nothing except fill it. Or, I will now step away from myself. I will now produce a power platform so that I can go into action. The fourth frame is God winding up in the bullpen, and in the fifth frame he pitches.
Bill, the last frame is a mathematical exhaustion of absolutes, really. I mean, you couldn't do any more than that, except function with
it. That's right. And you produce your first sub-absolutes.
Yeah.
In Havona, you set up, in principle, everything. Because as you take inventory of what is in Havona, and let me inventory it to refresh your memory. The creatures of the central universe are material, mirantial, spiritual, absonite, ultimate, co-absolute, and absolute. When the Eternal Son bestowed himself in Havona, I don't think the Havona natives knew anything about it, neither did Grand Fanda and his associates. This bestowal of the Eternal Son was something on the absolute, co-absolute level. And that's why the firstborn Michael bestowed himself in Havona, and his bestowal was an interpretation of the bestowal of the Eternal Son for the edification of these material, mirantial, spiritual, and maybe absonite beings in Havona. Did you ever stop and think that there's going to be a heck of a lot going on in Havona that will be just as invisible to us as seraphim are now? Havona represents the full expression of God's intent on all levels of the firehouse and in perfection. The finites in Havona are true finites, but not imperfect finites. They're primary finite maximums. No, Havona natives. In eternity, the Father portrayed the firehouse in utter perfection, all three floors. And then he commissioned his sons to go out here in time and space, and on a ...1% ratio, duplicate what he'd done. 10 million worlds is 1% of the size of Havona. Each Creator Son is taking on 1% of the load which the Trinity took on when they produced Havona. The tension presence of the Universal Absolute signifies the adjustment of differential between deified deity reality and undeified reality inherent in the separation of the dynamics of free will divinity from the statics of unqualified infinity. Frame three. No, he isn't in two. The tension's in two, but it's resolved in three. Always remember, potential infinity is absolute and inseparable from eternity. What do they mean by that? Well, At any moment in time, there is a future. And if there's a future, there's growth. And if there's growth, you can't express everything. Now, actual infinity in time can never be anything partial. That's what we just said. And therefore, must be non-absolute. If there is a future, we can't have it finished. Neither can infinity of actual personality be absolute except in unqualified deity. And it is the differential of infinity potential in the unqualified absolute and the deity absolute that eternalizes the universal absolute. This is explaining the origin of the universal absolute. Both of these circles in the second frame are infinite, but they're infinite in different ways. One is infinite statics, and the other is infinite dynamics. One is infinite causation, the other is infinite response. It is this differential of infinity potential that eternalizes the universal absolute. And this makes it possible, cosmically possible, to have material universes in space, and spiritually possible to have finite personalities in time. The firehouse is not going to cave in. There is Lebensraum for imperfect beings. We are not going to be crushed by the higher specific gravity of perfection. We're sort of like, let's say...
We might be crushed by a dump cop, so...
Oh, yes. The finite can coexist in the cosmos along with the infinite. Now we're talking about the construction, the steel lattice reinforcing construction of the lower floors of the firehouse, which keeps the uppermost floor from crushing the lower floors, and especially protects the lowest floor. The finite can coexist in the cosmos along with the infinite only because the associative presence of the universal absolute so perfectly equalizes a lot of tensions. And then they take inventory. What are these tensions? Time versus eternity. Finity versus infinity. Reality, the potential of reality versus the actuality of reality. Paradise versus space. Man versus God. If you have a glass full of water and you pour from another beaker quicksilver into that glass of water, what will happen? The quicksilver will displace the water. In this sense, perfection has a much higher specific gravity than imperfection. And how are we going to keep enough emptiness around here for imperfection to grow with a lower specific gravity in the presence of things which have a higher specific gravity? It's the universal absolute that keeps the quicksilver out of the glass of water, thus keeping us from being displaced in reality.
We can take the other side of that too. When we're settled in life and light, then the unqualified absolute will still function on some
The unqualified, the universal absolute has to function to protect everything which is sub-absolute. Because anything sub-absolute,
we're
still not absolute. We're just finite. We're perfected finites, but we're still on the first floor of the firehouse.
And it's not until we get to the third floor that we don't need the universal absolute?
Even on the third floor, we're not completed absolutes, and we never will be. And that's why, Helen, the function of the universal absolute is going to grow and grow and grow and grow, because there's going to be more and more and more of us. And that's what the censor means. Let's reread from paper 10 again. You see, the foreword really isn't hard. It explains these difficult passages elsewhere in the papers. It may be possible that the finaliters will partially attain the deity absolute. But even if they should, still, in the eternity of eternities, he's saying many, many now, the problem of the universal absolute will continue to intrigue, mystify, baffle, and challenge the ascending and progressing finaliters. For we perceive that the unfathomability of the cosmic relationships of the universal absolute will tend to grow in proportions as the material universes and their spiritual administration continue to expand. Doesn't that sentence now have a lot more meaning for you?
Much.
You see, what we're engaged in is Operation Bootstrap. We must take one part of the book to help us understand another part of the book.
There's a sentence, Bill, I'm going to repeat. Neither can infinity of actual personality be absolute except in unqualified deity. Would you explain?
The Father, the Son, the Spirit. Or, probably best understood in the Son, who is the absolute person. This is the Father's expression of personality, absoluteness, unqualified spirituality. The eternal Son is the unqualified Spirit. Both the Father and the conjoined actor are qualified spiritual beings. They are much besides being spiritual. They're just as spiritual as the Son, but they're everything else in addition. That's why the eternal Son can't fragment his nature. There is no part of the Son that is pre-personal to be fragmented. He is personality, nothing but personality. And he suffers from a limitation. In a sense, he is the least versatile of the three deities because he is the most absolute, absolutely unqualified, spiritual, personal deity. And he suffers from all the limitations of absoluteness. They don't write any section on the limitations of the Universal Father or the limitations of the Infinite Spirit, but they do write a section, the limitations of the Eternal Son. He has the most, therefore he is the most limited. He has the most perfect relationship with the three deities. He knows a father. And he also knows an offspring who is equal. The Father knows the experience of both being a father and a grandfather, but he has no father. The Infinite Spirit has the unique experience of double deity ancestry, but he knows no offspring who is his equal. His offspring are multiple and are sub-absolute. They are the seven master spirits. Each deity has such a unique relationship. They're not just three carbon copies up there. There is no greater possible difference between three people than exists between the three persons of deity. They are utterly dissimilar and yet equally divine.
Perfectly unified.
And perfectly unified. Yes.
Is there more from the eternal Son than personality and spirit?
No, that's it.
Is that it all?
That's it. He is unqualifiedly personal. He is unqualifiedly spiritual. The conjoined actor is the source of mind. We think of him as mind, but he's also spirit, like the Son. And it is this pre-mind spirit which he can fragment. He gives origin not only to the primary supernafim of paradise, but he gives origin to beings who in turn give origin to the physical control creatures. There's versatility. He can operate. He can play on all the pianos there are. He can even draw checks against the Universal Father's bank account because he's got an attorney in fact from the Father. If you, in terms of being, nothing escapes relationship to the Universal Father. In terms of function, nothing escapes relationship to the third source and center. Now, this is not true of the Eternal Son. Material reality has no relationship to the Eternal Son as such. spiritual reality has no relationship to paradise as the absolute machine. But both the first and third source and center cut right across the whole gamut of reality. Spiritual reality has no relationship to the unqualified absolute. And I don't think material reality has any relationship to the deity absolute. But all reality has relationship to the universal absolute.
If this weren't all so perfect, I think I could understand better.
Yes. Now, can you remember, we are on page 15?
Yes.
All right. We're going back to page 15, but I want to show you what we're talking about here in the papers. I want you to turn to page 1150 and let's look at the seventh triunity. We have been discussing the seventh triunity. This is the relationship between the universal father, the conjoint actor, and the universal absolute. The three realities that cut across everything. The conjoint act, this is the unity of infinity functionally manifest in time and eternity. This is the coordinate unification of actuals and potentials. This group consists of the Father, the conjoint actor, the universal absolute. The conjoint actor universally integrates the varying functional aspects of all actualized reality on all levels of manifestation, from finites through transcendentals and on to absolutes. He's dealing with actuals. He's not the source of all actuals, but he integrates, functionally integrates all actuality. The universal absolute perfectly compensates the differentials inherent in the varying aspects of all incomplete reality, potential reality, from the limitless potentials of active volitional and causative deity reality to the boundless possibilities of static, reactive, non-deity reality in the incomprehensible domains of the unqualified absolute. As they function in this triunity, the conjoint actor and the universal absolute are alike responsive to deity and to non-deity presences, as also is the first source and center, who, in this relationship, is to all intents and purposes conceptually indistinguishable from the I Am.
The whole,
this is the master linkage here of everything, functionally. So let's go back to paper 15, page 15.
Where the universal absolute perfectly compensates, would that even go down to the compensatory motion?
Yes, that's the fourth kind of motion. You better know that too. I'm going to ask you about how many kinds of motion are there. There are four kinds of motion. Primary motion is the motion of space itself, space respiration. It's an absolute motion because it's motion in relation to something non-moving, paradise. Secondary motion is also absolute motion. It's the clockwise, counterclockwise precessional of the space level. Tertiary motion is relative. It is all other motion other than the two that are inventoried, except for the fourth kind of motion, which is compensatory motion. Motion initiated by the universal absolute, designed to compensate the balance of the universe of universes. Who causes motion in space? The papers think it's the conjoint action.
Yeah, they can't prove it, but...
They can't?
What was that?
Who causes motion in space? The papers think it's the conjoint creator. But no one knows who causes the motion of space.
Isn't that a wonderful hypothesis, David? If he does, we can't prove it.
Yes, I know.
But let's say he does for a minute.
Yeah. When they use negatives, they're so ingenious. If he does, we cannot prove it. It's like discussing, why does a creative spirit produce less than supreme seraphim? She tries to produce nothing but supreme seraphim, but she gets them in all sub-supreme levels, as well as supreme. And they say, if this is due to an interference pattern on the part of the supreme being, we can't prove it. Actually, all I think that's happening there is that the supreme being is putting in a diffraction grating and breaking up the white light into a spectrum because it's more interesting.
Well, that's in line with the whole Dalton grading.
Sure it is.
Bill, don't you imagine that their debating clubs are just fantastic?
Sure.
They have something real to debate.
I think the real club is going to be the Masters of Philosophy on Paradise. That's going to be tremendous.
Why would the conjoint actor try to produce only perfect seraphim?
No, the creative spirit. A creative spirit, a local universe mother spirit.
The daughter of the conjoint.
Why would she produce anything less than supreme seraphim? That's her intent. But
why
she gets
is it her intent? Why doesn't
she wants
want
the best
down help in the downgrading?
She wants the best.
She thinks they can help.
They can move downward.
Sure.
Don't forget, a seraphim can devolve. And this is not backsliding. Those seraphim who were born at the vice presidential level are able to work their way down into the lower levels. And that's growth.
Their quality has nothing to do with their diversity.
No.
Why would the Supreme want to interfere?
Ma'am?
Why would the Supreme want to interfere?
It isn't Supreme, it's the third.
No, I think they're suspicious that it's the Supreme that's doing this, but they can't prove it. Actually, it works out better functionally because they get seraphim who are naturally born on all of these levels. And they can all travel to other levels and eventually do. A supreme seraphim is interested in experiential growth on the lower levels, just as Michael is. A seraphim born on one of the lower levels is interested on climbing the ladder. They're interested in going both ways on the ladder. Havona natives evolved this way. A real dirty question would be, this would be a junior question, of inventory the technique of evolutionary growth on the part of a Havona native since the days of Grand Fonda. Now there are three ways in which these Havona natives are moving around. Those from the outer circuit are exploring inward. Those from the inner circuits are exploring outward. And they're making intra-circuit progress. Havona's been all shook up ever since Grand Fonda arrived. The evolutionary growth technique invaded Havona from outer space.
Tiglath came up. I never saw a Tiglath before.
That's right. Associatively, now remember, every time you get something new, the universal absolute has got to take on more load. Are you with this? Do you see this now? This is Atlas, only up the earth. Associatively, the universal absolute constitutes the identification of the zone of progressing evolutional reality. And this reality exists on two levels of the firehouse, the time-space level and in the transcended time-space level, the second floor. And these two floors together are universes of sub-infinite deity manifestation. They're less than infinite. So here, you know, down in Washington, they've got a census meter, I'm told. I've never seen it. And you can see births and deaths clicking and the cumulative net total of the pluses and the minuses. And up on Paradise, we might paraphrase this. They've got a universal absolute meter. And you can see the load building up every time a new person's born, a new world comes into being. You see, as long as it's space potency, he doesn't have anything to compensate. Because that's secure in the grasp of his associate in qualified absolute. But the minute the force organizers start monkeying around with that, it becomes sub-absolute, and it clicks again. The load goes up. And this is why we're never going to catch him. He's growing in proportion to total cosmic growth. And we are growing only as one creature can grow, and we ourselves contribute to the addition of this load.
Is potentiality weightless?
To him, yes, if it's absolute potentiality. But sub-absolute potentiality would increase his load. And all potentiality, I don't think, is absolute. I think you have the potentials of the ultimate derived from up here. And I think you also have the potentialities of the supreme derived from up here, possibly through the ultimate. When a creative spirit produces seraphim, in the final analysis, I think she drafts on the deity absolute. But to all practical intents and purposes, I think the branch bank that cashes her check is the potentialities of the supreme, which is the local finite branch of the bank of the deity absolute.
He gets the power bill.
Yeah.
Probably.
She's drafting on finite potentials, not absolute potentials, because these seraphim are not absolute, they're finite. And I think the potentials of the supreme add to the load of the universal absolute. I think the potentials of the ultimate add to the load of the universal absolute. I do not think potentials on the absolute level add anything to his load.
But
all sub-absolute potentials, all sub-absolute actuals add to this load.
Yeah. These finite potentials are difficult to distinguish it by, at least right now I'm a little confused, confusing them with actuals.
All right. Ruth?
They are sub.
Let's limit finite potentials to the potentials of the present universe age. That's not their limit. But let's freeze it at that point.
Okay.
These finite potentials could be expressed as the perfected seven super universes and the completed and emergent supreme being.
Okay.
In eternity, these potentials are just as real as our finite actuals, because the only difference between what we call finite actuals and what we call finite potentials is time. And time is not real in eternity. Do you know something? We are not going to understand eternity, but we are going to become much less frightened by that word as a result of talking about it. I can't explain eternity to you, but I can share with you my fearlessness of eternity. I'm not afraid to think about it and talk about it. We don't have to be as ignorant of eternity.
It's close relation to potentiality.
Yes. We are talking now about the difference between first-degree many and second-degree many.
Could you talk about potentialities in something less...
rarefied? Yes, human germplasm.
Well, could it even be a force?
No, human germplasm, I think. Human germplasm is the best illustration I can give, or any germplasm.
There is...
species potentiality.
It's got to be something.
Yes.
There are Marantia potentialities on this planet.
In the soul.
Well, in this planet, because when they finally come down and give us this model of this Marantia temple, don't we build it out of our material that we have to find?
No.
They build it. Material?
The Marantia power. The Marantia...
Well, then they can catalyze something to make it.
Sure. They emulsify matter and spirit.
Okay.
That's all.
Well, the potentials of the unqualified absolute, are those something?
Yes, that's space potency.
Well, that's
That's the water vapor out of which...
That's force.
Yes, out of which they condense clouds, which we call nebula, out of which hail forms, which we call matter.
I see. That's the 100 elements.
Yes. This next paragraph is really very, very easy, if we go slowly. Very easy. Let's read it through once. The universal absolute is the potential of the static, dynamic deity, functionally realizable on time-eternity levels as finite absolute values and as possible of experiential existential approach. This incomprehensible aspect of deity may be static, potential, and associative, but is not experientially creative or evolutional as concerns the intelligent personalities now functioning in the master universe. Now, really, that isn't hard.
I just can't go that fast.
They're talking now about the universal absolute, not as an associative presence. But what is the universal absolute as such?
Association. Is this,
apart from the association. They're now considering this absolute as an absolute, not as a steel structure. As a third absolute. We've been talking about the unqualified absolute. We've been talking about the deity absolute. Up until this time, we've been talking about the universal absolute pretty much as just an associative presence. But is there any meaning or value to the universal absolute apart from the fact of association? Yes, there is. This is an inventory of the universal absolute all alone, apart from the deity and unqualified absolutes. He is the potential, which means he is an emptiness in which action can take place. I quote again from Lao Tzu, the virtue of an empty vessel is that it can be filled. The emptiness inherent in the universal absolute has the virtue of providing an arena in which action can take place and in which transactions can be consummated. The universal absolute is an emptiness. And what is this emptiness, this room for action? In this emptiness, static, dynamic deity can do something. What in the dickens is static, dynamic deity? It's the relationship between the deity absolute and the unqualified absolute. It can perform some functions. These functions are going to result in the realization of some things. And the things are going to take place, grow, evolve, be created, fragmentized, eventuated, on time-eternity levels. This is a conjoining of time and eternity. Is such a thing comprehensible? Why, certainly. An adjuster is an eternity entity, and we're time creatures. This is taking place right in our own experience. These things are going to be realized as finite absolute values. Well, the adjuster is a qualified absolute, and if anything is finite, we are. If the Supreme Being can ever associate with God the Ultimate, this is the same type of association taking place on a deity level, isn't it? And in the Trinity of Trinities, it's projected that finites and absolutes will be associated on the second level of the Trinity of Trinities, which would be made up of God the Supreme, God the Ultimate, and God the Absolute. And these goals are goals which are possible to an experiential, existential approach. Experiential, existential deity would be God the Absolute, which would represent the experientialization of the existential deity absolute. Anytime you use the term God the Absolute, you are assuming that the Deity Absolute has become experientially personified. The Deity Absolute is a pre-personal deity, not yet a person. Says, again, my old pal, the grizzled censor, I always think of him as growling, says this universal censor, we know the universal Father, the eternal Son, and the infinite Spirit as persons, but I do not personally know the Deity Absolute. I love and worship God the Father. I respect and honor the Deity Absolute. Those words give me a feeling for his feeling. Yes,
Helene. The Deity Absolute isn't personalized, but he said
he respected. No. No, the Deity Absolute is a pre-personal deity. God the Absolute is our conception of the personalization of that deity. The pre-personal Deity Absolute is an existential reality. The personalization of this Deity Absolute would be by experiential techniques. So, they're talking about the union of the existential and the experiential. If our conjecture about thought adjusters is correct, did they have an origin in time? I don't think so. Even if the Father should fragment an adjuster now, I think that transaction would take place above the stream of time. A thought adjuster is something like an existential reality, certainly an eternal reality. We are experiential realities. Here is another type of union taking place. You see, they're talking about us in here as well as deity. So, the universal absolute marks out a zone in which statics and dynamics can be associated. They can be associated on time-eternity levels. They can be associated as finite absolute values, and they can be approached by experiential existential techniques. This incomprehensible aspect of deity may be static, potential, and associative. Those are the first three levels of the function of total deity, but is not experientially creative, fourth level, or evolutional, fifth level, as concerns the intelligent personalities now functioning in the master universe. This is deity. This is not non-deity. But it's limited as to function. Whereas the Father is unlimited. The Trinity collaborates with the Supreme Being on the level of supremacy. The Father indwells us on the evolutional level. The Father once functioned as a creator cosmically and continues to function as a creator in personalities. Yes?
Why did it say the intelligent personality?
Oh, I think intelligent was almost redundant, but it means folks like you. I mean folks like us. The absolute. The two absolutes, qualified and unqualified, while so apparently divergent in function, as they may be observed by mind creatures, are perfectly and divinely unified in and by the universal absolute, third frame. In the last analysis and in the final comprehension, all three are one absolute. On sub-infinite levels, they are functionally differentiated, but in infinity, they are one, which is to say, our first picture on the blackboard is still real. Instead of thinking of these in sequence, stack them like pancakes. And then you can see how all are existent at the same time. The sequence is not destructive of any prior factor. They continue.
That's so well explained, I hope.
Sure. Let's consider the first source and center. Let's go back to page 4. This is the only discussion in the papers of the first source and center as such. They are not talking about the Universal Father. Here we take inventory for the first time in these papers of the seven absolutes of infinity. Father, Son, Spirit, Paradise, Deity, Universal, and Unqualified Absolute. The first source and center is original reality. The next three are actual reality. The last three are potential reality. God, the Universal Father, is the personality of the first source and center. Now, he's had the experience in one level of our stack of pancakes of being just like the Deity Absolute, pre-personal. He is pre-personal. He is never not personal. The least you can say about God is that in a certain sense he is pre-personal. But you must then quickly add he is also personal. And then you should add he is also super-personal. And these are the sub-absolute manifestations of God. He is, to all functional intents and purposes, still pre-personal because he still sends out thought adjusters, fragments of his pre-personal nature. He's personal because he creates. He, this very day on Paradise, may be creating a creator son in conjunction with the eternal son. He is a continuing creator. He eventuates. How, I don't know, except he's not creating now. But he's doing something that brings something into existence. And this adds to the personnel of the absonite level. He's both actual and potential. He's both deity and he is not deity. God, the Universal Father, is the personality of the first source and center, and as such maintains personal relations of infinite control over all coordinate and subordinate sources and centers. Such control is personal and infinite in potential, even though it may never actually function owing to the perfection of the function of such coordinate and subordinate sources and centers and personalities. God could take over the administration of spiritual gravity, but why should he perform such a needless and redundant act? The Father himself could not improve on the function of the Eternal Son in that domain because the Eternal Son is the perfect and final expression of the Father's creative purpose as concerns that domain. In other words, the Father doesn't actually interfere with anything because everything is working perfectly at this level. Even if it doesn't work quite perfectly, I don't think he interferes. Let's take a Michael son. He's not absolutely perfect. And what's more, he's coping with reactions that are beyond his control. The free will actions of really imperfect beings. But the Father doesn't interfere. He lets this creator, Michael, work it out. At least he doesn't interfere on the finite level. What he is doing on upper levels, I don't know. But they do say that blind and unforeseen accidents do not happen in the cosmos. but on the finite level. And working with my time units, which are pretty short, I've got to use the word chance. Even though I am told in the papers that chance is a word which signifies that man is either too lazy or too ignorant to find out. If I knew enough, I would eliminate the word chance from my vocabulary. But practically speaking, I can't live without it, neither can you folks.
Could you go to Las Vegas then? And,
You know, the cutest cartoon I've ever seen on that score was a young couple talking to an older man, probably a parent. And the young couple were in very good shape, except there was a perfect cut, just like made with a circular saw, and their derrières were missing. And the older person was saying, "How did you make out in Las Vegas?" The first source and center is therefore primal in all domains. Deified or undeified, personal or impersonal, actual or potential, finite or infinite. No thing or being, no relativity or finality exists except in direct or indirect relation to and dependence on the primacy of the first source and center. Over on page 1153, the paragraph starting in about the middle of the page. Ever remember that man's comprehension of the Universal Father is a personal experience. God, as your spiritual father, is comprehensible to you and to all other mortals. But your experiential, worshipful concept of the Universal Father must always be less than your philosophic postulate of the infinity of the first source and center, the I Am. The Father is the personality of the first source and center. Any of us can sense the personality of any of us because we are persons. But this does not mean that we necessarily comprehend the physiology of that person, the anatomy of that person, the endocrinology of that person, the cortex of that person, or any other aspect of that person except his contactable personality and that which goes with it.
Does that mean that the philosophic postulate is more basic?
It's more big. No, not more basic.
The other is the means, isn't it? The experience is the means to the intellectual postulate.
Oh, yes. When you think about
the... this is saying the opposite.
No. The term first source and center is a larger term than Universal Father,
yes,
but not a more meaningful term to human beings. The meaning is inversely proportional to the size of the concept. It is the smallest concept of the universe, of the first source and center, that has meaning to us. The deity of the first source and center is a larger concept than the word God, because the word God implies personality, and deity may be larger than personality. The deity of the first source and center would encompass his prepersonal and superpersonal functions. The word God implies only his personal functions and relationships. And the word Father is the smallest word of all. The word Father takes that aspect of God which is related to us and names it. The smallest idea of God is the most meaningful, because God is much too big for us.
Well,
Therefore, as we narrow our concept, our feeling for meaning increases, and the value of the concept goes up enormously to us. We worship the Father. We do not worship the first source and center as such, except as we, by implication, worship him in our worship of the Father. Jesus at no time attempted to portray any aspect of God larger than the Father aspect. That was a job in itself. Yes, he never attempted to portray the justice of the Trinity, just the love of the Father. He stopped the story of the prodigal son before justice entered the picture. He merely portrayed a father's joy. I've often wondered, did they redivide the property or what?
Bill, what are they saying here that God is much more than a father, but the father has ideas?
It's, we'll find it.
It's in this paper on Being in Reality.
I don't know. When we speak of the Father, we mean God as he is understandable by his creatures, both high and low. But there is much more of deity which is not comprehensible to universe creatures. God, your Father, and my Father is that phase of the infinite which we perceive in our personalities as an actual experiential reality. But the I am ever remains as our hypothesis of all that we feel is unknowable of the first source and center. And even that hypothesis probably falls far short of the unfathomed infinity of original reality. This is a Melchizedek. The universe of universes, with its innumerable host of inhabiting personalities, is a vast and complex organism. But the first source and center is infinitely more complex than the universes and personalities which have become real in response to his willful mandates. When you stand in awe of the magnitude of the master universe, pause to consider that even this inconceivable creation can be no more than a partial revelation of the infinite. Infinity is indeed remote from the experience level of mortal comprehension. But even in this age on Urantia, your concepts of infinity are growing. Many, many. And they will continue to grow throughout your endless career stretching onward into future eternity. Unqualified infinity is meaningless to the finite creature. But infinity is capable of self-limitation and is susceptible of reality expression to all levels of universe existence. That's the pole running through all levels of the firehouse. And the face which the infinite turns toward all universe personalities is the face of the Father, the universal Father of love. We're tackling a concept here which is tougher than the unqualified absolute. The unqualified absolute is a comforting concept. I can't know anything about it. But this is a much more intriguing concept. I can know much about this even now. I can even feel something of this. Let's go back to the preceding page. We're backing into this concept. The bottom of the page. The I am is the infinite. The I am is also infinity. That's the infinite. This is infinity.
Please repeat.
The yolk is the infinite.
Yes.
The white is infinity.
The infinite, yes.
There's an implication of the personal and the not personal there. Infinity is not a person, but the infinite, yes. From the sequential time viewpoint, all reality has its origin in the infinite I am, whose solitary existence in past infinite eternity must be a finite creature's premier philosophic postulate. They validated our first frame. The concept of the I am connotes unqualified infinity, the undifferentiated reality of all that could ever be in all of an infinite eternity. As an existential concept, the I am is neither deified nor undeified, neither actual nor potential, neither personal nor impersonal, neither static nor dynamic. No qualification can be applied to the infinite except to state that the I am is. The philosophic postulate of the I am is the one universe concept which is somewhat more difficult of comprehension than that of the unqualified absolute. To a finite mind, there simply must be a beginning. And though there never was a real beginning to reality, still there are certain source relationships which reality manifests to infinity. The pre-reality, primordial, eternity situation must be thought of something like this. They're now going to describe our first frame up here. At some infinitely distant, hypothetical, past eternity moment, hypothetical meaning we've gone through the looking glass, at this moment, the I am may be conceived as both thing and no thing, as both cause and effect, as both volition and response. At this hypothetical eternity moment, there is no differentiation throughout all infinity. Infinity is filled by the infinite. The infinite encompasses infinity. This is the hypothetical static moment of eternity. What's the first level of total deity function? Static. Actuals are still contained within their potentials, and potentials have not yet appeared within the infinity of the I am. And now they make that vital statement, we do not have a custard, we have a fried egg. But even in this conjectured situation, we must assume the existence of the possibility of self-will. A custard is undifferentiated. A fried egg is clearly differentiated. These papers do not validate a monad. The word monad would be a custard. They validate, at best, a unified duality. In considering, we're jumping over our introduction, the genesis of reality, ever bear in mind that all absolute reality is from eternity and is without beginning of existence, our last frame. By absolute reality, we refer to the three existential persons of deity, the Isle of Paradise, and the three absolutes. These seven realities are coordinately eternal, notwithstanding that we resort to time-space language in presenting their sequential origins to human beings.